oaths were redoubled when they caught sight of her.
"Here she comes! Here she comes!" they cried. "Three cheers for the little girl! Ah, she put it across the old gentleman properly, she did!"
"And we're extremely regrettable," said the chief monopod, "that we can't give you the pleasure of seeing us as we were before we were uglified. For you wouldn't believe the difference, and that's the truth. For there's no denying we're mortal ugly now, so we won't deceive you."
"Aye, that we are, chief, that we are,"
echoed the others, bouncing like so many toy balloons.
"You've said it, you've said it."
"But I don't think you are at all,"
said Lucy, shouting to make herself heard.
"I think you look very nice."
"Hear her, hear her," said the monopods. "True for you, missy, very nice we look. You couldn't find a handsomer lot."
They said this without any surprise, and did not seem to notice that they had changed their minds.
"She's a-saying," remarked the chief monopod, "as how we look very nice before we were uglified."
"True for you, chief, true for you,"
chanted the others.
"That's what she says, we heard her ourselves."
"I did not," bawled Lucy. "I said you're very nice now."
"So she did, so she did," said the chief monopod. "Said we were very nice then."
"Hear 'em both, hear 'em both," said the monopods. "There's a pair for you, always right. They couldn't have put it better."
"But we're saying just the opposite," said Lucy, stamping her foot with impatience.
"So you are, to be sure, so you are," said the monopods. "Nothing like an opposite. Keep it up, both of you."
"You are enough to drive anyone mad," said Lucy, and gave it up.
But the monopods seemed perfectly contented, and she decided that on the whole the conversation had been a success. And before everyone went to bed that evening, something else happened, which made them even more satisfied with their one-legged condition. Caspian and all the Narnians went back as soon as possible to the shore to give their news to Rince and the others on board the Dawn Treader, who were by now very anxious. And, of course, the monopods went with them, bouncing like footballs and agreeing with one another in loud voices, till Eustace said, "I wish the magician would make them inaudible instead of invisible." He was soon sorry he had spoken, because then he had to explain that an inaudible thing is something you can't hear. And though he took a lot of trouble, he never felt sure that the monopods had really understood. And what especially annoyed him was that they said in the end,
"Hey, he can't put things the way our chief does. But you learn, young man. Hark to him. He'll show you how to say things. There's a speaker for you."
When they reached the bay, Reepy Cheep had a brilliant idea. He had his little coracle lowered and paddled himself about in it till the monopods were thoroughly interested. He then stood up in it and said,
"Worthy and intelligent monopods, you do not need boats. Each of you has a foot that will do instead. Just jump as lightly as you can on the water and see what happens." "That's what we are," they bellowed. "Moneypads, Bobbinods, Bodymons. Just what it was on the tips of our tongues to call ourselves."
But they soon got it mixed up with their old name of Duffers, and finally settled down to calling themselves the Duffelpuds. And that is what they will probably be called for centuries. That evening,
all the Narnians dined upstairs with the magician, and Lucy noticed how different the whole top floor looked now that she was no longer afraid of it. The mysterious signs on the doors were still mysterious, but now looked as if they had kind and cheerful meanings, and even the bearded mirror now seemed funny rather than frightening. At dinner, everyone had, by magic, what everyone liked best to eat and drink, and after dinner the magician did a very useful and beautiful piece of magic. He laid two blank sheets of parchment on the table and asked Drinian to give him an exact account of their voyage up to date. And as Drinian spoke, everything he described came out on the parchment, in fine, clear lines, till at last each sheet was a splendid map of the Eastern Ocean, showing Galma, Terebinthia, the Seven Isles, the Lone Islands, Dragon Island, Burnt Island, Death Water, and the land of the Duffers itself, all exactly the right sizes and in the right positions. They were the first maps ever made of those seas, and better than any that have been made since without magic. For on these, though the towns and mountains looked at first just as they would on an ordinary map, when the magician lent them a magnifying glass, you saw that they were perfect little pictures of the real things, so that you could see the very castle and slave market and streets in Narrowhaven, all very clear, though very distant, like things seen through the wrong end of a telescope. The only drawback was that the coastline of most of the islands was incomplete, for the map showed only what Drinian had seen with his own eyes. When they were finished, the magician kept one himself and presented the other to Caspian. It still hangs in his chamber of instruments at Caer Paribel. But the magician could tell them nothing about seas or lands further east. He did, however, tell them that about 7 years before a Narnian ship had put in at his waters, and that she had on board the lords Rebilion, Argos, Mavramorn, and Roop. So they judged that the golden man they had seen lying in Death Water must be the Lord Restimar. Next day the magician magically mended the stern of the Dawn Treader, where it had been damaged by the sea serpent, and loaded her with useful gifts. There was a most friendly parting, and when she sailed, 2 hours after noon, all the Duffelpuds paddled out with her to the harbour mouth, and cheered until she was out of sound of their cheering. Chapter 12. The Dark Island. After this adventure, they sailed on south and a little east for 12 days, with a gentle wind, the skies being mostly clear and the air warm, and saw no bird or fish, except that once there were whales spouting a long way to starboard. Lucy and Weepychee played a good deal of chess at this time. Then, on the 13th day, Edmund, from the fighting top, sighted what looked like a great dark mountain, rising out of the sea on their port bow. They altered course and made for this land, mostly by oar, for the wind would not serve them to sail northeast. When evening fell, they were still a long way from it and rowed all night. The next morning the weather was fair, but a flat calm prevailed. The dark mass lay ahead, much nearer and larger, but still very dim, so that some thought it was still a long way off, and others thought they were running into a mist. About 9 that morning, very suddenly, it was so close that they could see that it was not land at all, nor, even in an ordinary sense, a mist. It was a darkness. It is rather hard to describe, but you will see what it was like if you imagine yourself looking into the mouth of a railway tunnel, a tunnel either so long or so twisty that you cannot see the light at the far end. And you know what it would be like. For a few feet, you would see the rails and sleepers and gravel in broad daylight. Then there would come a place where they were in twilight, and then, pretty suddenly, but of course without a sharp dividing line, they would vanish altogether into smooth, solid blackness. It was just so here. For a few feet in front of their bows they could see the swell of the bright greenish-blue water,
Beyond that, they could see the water looking pale and grey, as it would look late in the evening. But beyond that again, utter blackness, as if they had come to the edge of moonless and starless night. Caspian shouted to the boatswain to keep her back, and all except the rowers rushed forward and gazed from the bows. But there was nothing to be seen by gazing. Behind them was the sea and the sun, before them the darkness. "Do we go into this?" asked Caspian at length.
"Not by my advice," said Drinian.
"The captain's right," said several sailors. "I almost think he is," said Edmund. Lucy and Eustace didn't speak, but they felt very glad inside at the turn things seemed to be taking. But all at once the clear voice of Weepy Cheep broke in upon the silence.
"And why not?" he said. "Will someone explain to me why not?"
No one was anxious to explain, so Reepy Cheep continued.
"If I were addressing peasants or slaves," he said, "I might suppose that this suggestion proceeded from cowardice. But I hope it will never be told in Narnia that a company of noble and royal persons in the flower of their age turned tail because they were afraid of the dark."
"But what manner of use would it be, ploughing through that blackness?" asked Drinian.
"Use!" replied Reepy Cheep. "Use, Captain! If by use you mean filling our bellies or our purses, I confess it will be no use at all. So far as I know, we did not set sail to look for things useful, but to seek honour and adventure. And here is as great an adventure as ever I heard of. And here, if we turn back, no little impeachment of all our honours."
Several of the sailors said things under their breath that sounded like, "Honour be blowed." But Caspian said,
"Oh, bother you, Reepy Cheep. I almost wish we'd left you at home.
All right, if you put it that way. I suppose we shall have to go on. Unless Lucy would rather not." Lucy felt that she would very much rather not, but what she said out loud was,
"I'm game."
"Your Majesty would at least order lights," said Drinian.
"By all means," said Caspian. "See to it, Captain." So the three lanterns at the stern and the prow and the masthead were all lit, and Drinian ordered two torches amidships. Pale and feeble they looked in the sunshine. Then all the men, except some who were left below at the oars, were ordered on deck, and fully armed, and posted in their battle stations with swords drawn. Lucy and two archers were posted on the fighting top with bows bent and arrows on the string. Reinulf was in the bows, with his line ready to take sounding. Reepy Cheep, Edmund, Eustace and Caspian, glittering in mail, were with him. Drinian took the tiller.
"And now, in Aslan's name, forward," cried Caspian. "A slow, steady stroke, and let every man be silent and keep his ears open for orders."
With a creak and a groan, the Dawn Treader started to creep forward as the men began to row. Lucy, up in the fighting top, had a wonderful view of the exact moment at which they entered the darkness. The bows had already disappeared before the sunlight had left the stern. She saw it go. At one minute the gilded stern, the blue sea and the sky were all in broad daylight. Next minute the sea and sky had vanished. The stern lantern, which had been hardly noticeable before, was the only thing to show where the ship ended. In front of the lantern she could see the black shape of Drinian crouching at the tiller. Down below her the two torches made visible two small patches of deck and gleamed on swords and helmets, and forward there was another island of light on the forecastle. Apart from that, the fighting top, lit by the masthead light which was only just above her, seemed to be a little lighted world of its own, floating in lonely darkness. And the lights themselves, as always happens with lights when you have to have them at the wrong time of day, looked lurid and unnatural. She also noticed that she was very cold. How long this voyage into the darkness lasted, nobody knew.
Except for the creak of the rowlocks and the splash of the oars, there was nothing to show that they were moving at all. Edmund, peering from the bows, could see nothing, except the reflection of the lantern in the water before him. It looked a greasy sort of reflection, and the ripple, made by their advancing prow, appeared to be heavy, small, and lifeless. As time went on, everyone except the rowers began to shiver with cold. Suddenly, from somewhere, no one's sense of direction was very clear by now, there came a cry, either of some inhuman voice, or else a voice of one in such extremity of terror that he had almost lost his humanity. Caspian was still trying to speak, his mouth was too dry, when the shrill voice of Rinkinchip, which sounded louder than usual in that silence, was heard.
"Who calls?"
it piped.
"If you are a foe, we do not fear you, and if you are a friend, your enemies shall be taught the fear of us."
"Mercy!" cried the voice. "Mercy! Even if you are only one dream, have mercy! Take me on board! Take me, even if you strike me dead! But in the name of all mercies, do not fade away and leave me in this horrible land!"
"Where are you?" shouted Caspian. "Come aboard and welcome!" There came another cry, whether of joy or terror, and then they knew that someone was swimming towards them. "Stand by to heave him up, men," said Caspian.
"Aye, aye, your majesty," said the sailors.
Several crowded to the port bulwark with ropes, and one, leaning far out over the side, held the torch. A wild, white face appeared in the blackness of the water, and then, after some scrambling and pulling, a dozen friendly hands had heaved the stranger on board. Edmund thought he had never seen a wilder-looking man. Though he did not otherwise look very old, his hair was an untidy mop of white. His face was thin and drawn, and for clothing only a few wet rags hung about him. But what one mainly noticed were his eyes, which were so widely opened that he seemed to have no eyelids at all, and stared as if in an agony of pure fear. The moment his feet reached the deck, he said,
"Fly! Fly! About with your ship and fly! Row, row, row for your lives away from this cursed shore!"
"Compose yourself," said Rinkinchip, "and tell us what the danger is. We are not used to flying."
The stranger started horribly at the voice of the mouse, which he had not noticed before.
"Nevertheless, you will fly from here," he gasped. "This is the island where dreams come true."
"That's the island I've been looking for this long time," said one of the sailors. "I reckon I'd find I was married to Nancy if we landed here."
"And I'd find Tom alive again," said another.
"Fools!" said the man, stamping his foot with rage. "That is the sort of talk that brought me here, and I'd better have been drowned or never born. Do you hear what I say? This is where dreams, do you understand, come to life, come real, not daydreams, dreams!"
There was about half a minute's silence, and then, with a great clatter of armour, the whole crew were tumbling down the main hatch as quick as they could, and flinging themselves on the oars, to row as they had never rowed before. And Drinian was swinging round the tiller, and the boatswain was giving out the quickest stroke that ever had been heard at sea, for it had taken everyone just that half minute to remember certain dreams they had had, dreams that make you afraid of going to sleep again, and to realize what it would mean to land on a country where dreams come true. Only Rinkinchip remained unmoved.
"Your Majesty, Your Majesty," he said, "are you going to tolerate this mutiny, this poltroonery? This is a panic, this is a rout."
"Row, row," bellowed Caspian. "Pull for all our lives. Is our head right, Drinian? You can say what you like, Rinkinchip. There are some things no man can face."
"It is then my good fortune not to be a man," replied Rinkinchip.
with a very stiff bow. Lucy, from up aloft, had heard it all. In an instant, one of her own dreams, which she had tried hardest to forget, came back to her, as vividly as if she had only just woken from it. So that was what was behind them, on the island in the darkness. For a second she wanted to go down to the deck and be with Edmund and Caspian. But what was the use? If dreams began coming true, Edmund and Caspian themselves might turn into something horrible just as she reached them. She gripped the rail of the fighting top and tried to steady herself. They were rowing back to the light as hard as they could. It would be all right in a few seconds, but oh, if only it could be all right now! Though the rowing made a good deal of noise, it did not quite conceal the total silence which surrounded the ship. Everyone knew it would be better not to listen, not to strain his ears for any sound from the darkness. But no one could help listening, and soon everyone was hearing things. Each one heard something different. "Do you hear a noise like a huge pair of scissors opening and shutting? Over there!" Eustace asked Reinelf.
"Hush!" said Reinelf. "I can hear them crawling up the sides of the ship."
"It's just going to settle on the mast," said Caspian.
"Oh!" said a sailor. "There are the gongs beginning on you, they would!"
Caspian, trying not to look at anything, especially not to keep looking behind him, went aft to Drinian.
"Drinian," he said in a very low voice, "how long did we take rowing in? I mean, rowing to where we picked up the stranger?"
5 minutes, perhaps," whispered Drinian. "Why?"
"Because we've been more than that already, trying to get out." Drinian's hand shook on the tiller, and a line of cold sweat ran down his face. The same idea was occurring to everyone on board.
"We shall never get out, never get out,"
moaned the rowers.
"He's steering us wrong. We're going round and round in circles. We shall never get out."
The stranger, who had been lying in a huddled heap on the deck, sat up and burst out into a horrible screaming laugh.
"Never get out!"
he yelled.
"That's it! Of course! We shall never get out! What a fool I was to have thought they would let me go as easily as that! No, no, we shall never get out!"
Lucy leant her head on the edge of the fighting top and whispered,
"Aslan, Aslan, if ever you loved us at all, send us help now!"
The darkness did not grow any less, but she began to feel a little, a very, very little better.
"After all, nothing has really happened to us yet," she thought.
"Look!"
cried Ryanulf's voice hoarsely from the bows. There was a tiny speck of light ahead, and while they watched, a broad beam of light fell from it upon the ship. It did not alter the surrounding darkness, but the whole ship was lit up as if by searchlight. Caspian blinked, stared round, saw the faces of his companions, all with wild, fixed expressions. Everyone was staring in the same direction. Behind everyone lay his black, sharply edged shadow. Lucy looked along the beam and presently saw something in it. At first it looked like a cross, then it looked like an aeroplane, then it looked like a kite, and at last, with a whirring of wings, it was right overhead, and was an albatross. It circled 3 times round the mast, and then perched for an instant on the crest of the gilded dragon at the prow. It called out in a strong, sweet voice what seemed to be words, though no one understood them. After that, it spread its wings, rose, and began to fly slowly ahead, bearing a little to starboard. Drinian steered after it, not doubting that it offered good guidance. But no one except Lucy knew that as it circled the mast it had whispered to her,
"Courage, dear heart." And the voice she felt sure was Aslan's, and with the voice a delicious smell breathed in her face.
In a few moments the darkness turned into a greyness ahead, and then, almost before they dared to begin hoping,
They had shot out into the sunlight, and were in the warm, blue world again. And all at once everybody realized that there was nothing to be afraid of, and never had been. They blinked their eyes and looked about them. The brightness of the ship herself astonished them. They had half expected to find that the darkness would cling to the white and the green and the gold in the form of some grime or scum. And then first one and then another began laughing.
"I reckon we've made pretty good fools of ourselves," said Reinulf.
Lucy lost no time in coming down to the deck, where she found the others all gathered round the newcomer. For a long time he was too happy to speak, and could only gaze at the sea and the sun and feel the bulwarks and the ropes, as if to make sure he was really awake, while tears rolled down his cheeks.
"Thank you," he said at last. "You have saved me from... But I won't talk of that. And now let me know who you are."
"I am a Telmarin of Narnia, and when I was worth anything, men called me the Lord Roop." "And I," said Caspian, "am Caspian, King of Narnia, and I sail to find you and your companions, who were my father's friends." Lord Roop fell on his knees and kissed the king's hand.
"Sire," he said, "you are the man in all the world I most wish to see. Grant me a boon."
"What is it?" asked Caspian.
"Never to bring me back there," he said.
He pointed astern. They all looked, but they saw only bright blue sea and bright blue sky. The dark island and the darkness had vanished for ever.
"Why," cried Lord Roop, "you have destroyed it!"
"I don't think it was us," said Lucy.
"Sire," said Rinian, "this wind is fair for the southeast. Shall I have our poor fellows up and set sail? And after that, every man who can be spared to his hammock."
"Yes," said Caspian, "and let there be grog all round."
"Hey-ho! I feel I could sleep the clock round myself."
So, all afternoon, with great joy, they sailed southeast with a fair wind. But nobody noticed when the albatross had disappeared. Chapter 13. The Three Sleepers. The wind never failed, but it grew gentler every day, till at length the waves were little more than ripples, and the ship glided on hour after hour, almost as if they were sailing on a lake. And every night they saw that there rose in the east new constellations, which no one had ever seen in Narnia, and perhaps, as Lucy thought, with a mixture of joy and fear, no living eye had seen at all. Those new stars were big and bright, and the nights were warm. Most of them slept on deck and talked far into the night, or hung over the ship's side, watching the luminous dance of the foam thrown up by their bows. On an evening of startling beauty, when the sunset behind them was so crimson and purple and widely spread that the very sky itself seemed to have grown larger, they came in sight of land on their starboard bow. It came slowly nearer, and the light behind them made it look as if the capes and headlands of this new country were all on fire. But presently they were sailing along its coast, and its western cape now rose up astern of them, black against the red sky, and sharp as if it was cut out of cardboard. And then they could see better what this country was like. It had no mountains, but many gentle hills, with slopes like pillows. An attractive smell came from it, what Lucy called a dim, purple kind of smell, which Edmund said, and Rince thought, was rot. But Caspian said, "I know what you mean." They sailed on a good way, past point after point, hoping to find a nice deep harbour, but had to content themselves in the end with a wide and shallow bay. Though it had seemed calm out at sea, there was, of course, surf breaking on the sand, and they could not bring the Dawn Treader as far in as they would have liked.
They dropped anchor a good way away from the beach, and had a wet and tumbling landing in the boat. The Lord Roop remained on board the Dawn Treader. He wished to see no more islands. All the time that they remained in this country, the sound of the long breakers was in their ears. Two men were left to guard the boat, and Caspian led the others inland. But not far, because it was too late for exploring, and the light would soon go. But there was no need to go far to find an adventure. The level valley which lay at the head of the bay showed no road or track or other sign of habitation. Underfoot was fine springy turf, dotted here and there with a low bushy growth which Edmund and Lucy took for heather. Eustace, who was really rather good at botany, said it wasn't, and he was probably right. But it was something of very much the same kind. When they had gone less than a bowshot from the shore, Drinian said,
"Look! What's that?"
And everyone stopped. "Are they great trees?" said Caspian.
"Towers, I think," said Eustace.
"It might be giants," said Edmund in a lower voice.
"The way to find out is to go right in among them," said Reepy Cheep,
drawing his sword and pattering off ahead of everyone else.
"I think it's a ruin," said Lucy,
when they had got a good deal nearer, and her guess was the best so far. What they now saw was a wide, oblong space, flagged with smooth stones and surrounded by grey pillars, but unroofed, and from end to end of it ran a long table, laid with a rich crimson cloth that came down nearly to the pavement. At either side of it were many chairs of stone, richly carved, and with silken cushions upon the seats. But on the table itself there was set out such a banquet as had never been seen, not even when Peter, the High King, kept his court at Caer Paribel. There were turkeys and geese and peacocks. There were boar's heads and sides of venison. There were pies shaped like ships under full sail, or like dragons and elephants. There were ice puddings and bright lobsters and gleaming salmon. There were nuts and grapes, pineapples and peaches, pomegranates and melons and tomatoes. There were flagons of gold and silver, and curiously wrought glass. And the smell of the fruit and the wine blew towards them like a promise of all happiness.
"I say," said Lucy.
They came nearer and nearer, all very quietly.
"But where are the guests?" asked Eustace.
"We can provide that, sir," said Rince.
"Look," said Edmund sharply. They were actually within the pillars now, and standing on the pavement. Everyone looked where Edmund had pointed. The chairs were not all empty. At the head of the table, and in the two places beside it, there was something, or possibly three somethings.
"What are those?" asked Lucy in a whisper. "It looks like three beavers sitting on the table."
"Or a huge bird's nest," said Edmund.
"It looks more like a haystack to me," said Caspian.
Reepy Cheep ran forward, jumped on a chair and thence onto the table, and ran along it, threading his way as nimbly as a dancer between jewelled cups and pyramids of fruit and ivory salt-cellars. He ran right up to the mysterious grey mass at the end, peered, touched, and then called out,
"These will not fight, I think."
Everyone now came close, and saw that what sat in those three chairs was three men, though hard to recognise as men till you look closely. Their hair, which was grey, had grown over their eyes, till it almost concealed their faces. And their beards had grown over the table, climbing round and entwining plates and goblets as brambles entwine a fence, until, all mixed in one great mat of hair, they flowed over the edge and down to the floor. And from their heads their hair hung over the backs of their chairs, so that they were wholly hidden. In fact, the three men were nearly all hair.
"Dead?"
said Caspian.
"I think not, sire,"
said Reepy Cheep, lifting one of their hands out of its tangle of hair in his two paws.
"This one is warm, and his pulse beats."
"This one, too, and this," said Drinian.
"Why, they're only asleep," said Eustace.
"It's been a long sleep, though," said Edmund, "to let the hair grow like this."
"It must be an enchanted sleep," said Lucy. "I felt the moment we landed on this island that it was full of magic. Oh, do you think we have perhaps come here to break it?"
"We can try," said Caspian, and began shaking the nearest of the three sleepers. For a moment, everyone thought he was going to be successful, for the man breathed hard and muttered,
"I'll go eastward no more. Out oars for Narnia."
But he sank back almost at once into a yet deeper sleep than before. That is, his heavy head sagged a few inches lower towards the table, and all efforts to rouse him again were useless. With the second, it was much the same.
"Weren't born to live like animals. Get to the east while you've a chance. Lands behind the sun."
And sank down. And the third only said,
"Mustard, please."
And slept hard.
"Out oars for Narnia, eh?" said Drinian.
"Yes," said Caspian. "You are right, Drinian. I think our quest is at an end. Let's look at their rings."
"Yes, these are their devices. This is the Lord Rebellion. This is the Lord Argos. And this, the Lord Mavramorn."
"But we can't wake them," said Lucy. "What are we to do?"
"Begging your Majesty's pardons all," said Rince. "But why not fall to while you're discussing it? We don't see a dinner like this every day."
"Not for your life," said Caspian. "That's right, that's right," said several of the sailors. "Too much magic about here. The sooner we're back on board, the better."
"Depend upon it," said Reepy Cheep, "it was from eating this food that these three lords came by a 7 years' sleep."
"I wouldn't touch it to save my life," said Drinian.
"The light's going uncommon quick," said Rhynelf.
"Back to ship, back to ship," muttered the men.
"I really think," said Edmund, "they're right. We can decide what to do with the three sleepers tomorrow. We daren't eat the food, and there's no point in staying here for the night. The whole place smells of magic and danger."
"I am entirely of King Edmund's opinion," said Reepy Cheep, "as far as concerns the ship's company in general. But I myself will sit at this table till sunrise."
"Why on earth?" said Eustace.
"Because,"
said the Mouse,
"this is a very great adventure, and no danger seems to me so great as that of knowing when I get back to Narnia that I left a mystery behind me through fear."
"I'll stay with you, Reep," said Edmund.
"And I too," said Caspian.
"And me,"
said Lucy.
And then Eustace volunteered also. This was very brave of him, because never having read of such things, or even heard of them, till he joined the Dawn Treader, made it worse for him than for the others.
"I beseech your Majesty," began Drinian.
"No, my lord," said Caspian. "Your place is with the ship, and you have had a day's work while we five have idled." There was a lot of argument about this, but in the end Caspian had his way. As the crew marched off to the shore in the gathering dusk, none of the five watchers, except perhaps Reepy Cheep, could avoid a cold feeling in the stomach.
They took some time choosing their seats at the perilous table. Probably everyone had the same reason, but no one said it out loud. But it was really a rather nasty choice. One could hardly bear to sit all night next to those three terrible, hairy objects, which, if not dead, were certainly not alive in the ordinary sense. On the other hand, to sit at the far end so that you would see them less and less as the night grew darker and wouldn't know if they were moving, and perhaps wouldn't see them at all by about 2 o'clock,
No, it was not to be thought of.
So they sauntered round and round the table, saying, "What about here?" And, "Or perhaps a bit further on?" Or, "Why not on this side?" Till at last they settled down somewhere about the middle, but nearer to the sleepers than to the other end. It was about 10 by now, and almost dark. Those strange new constellations burned in the east. Lucy would have liked it better if they had been the leopard and the ship and other old friends of the Narnian sky. They wrapped themselves in their sea cloaks and sat still and waited. At first there was some attempt at talk, but it didn't come to much. And they sat and sat. And all the time they heard the waves breaking on the beach. After hours that seemed like ages, there came a moment when they all knew that they had been dozing a moment before, but were all suddenly wide awake. The stars were all in quite different positions from those they had last noticed. The sky was very black, except for the faintest possible greyness in the east. They were cold, though thirsty and stiff, and none of them spoke, because now at last something was happening. Before them, beyond the pillars, there was the slope of a low hill, and now a door opened in the hillside, and light appeared in the doorway, and a figure came out, and the door shut behind it. The figure carried a light, and this light was really all that they could see distinctly. It came slowly, nearer and nearer, till at last it stood right at the table opposite to them. Now they could see that it was a tall girl, dressed in a single long garment of clear blue, which left her arms bare. She was bareheaded, and her yellow hair hung down her back, and when they looked at her, they thought that they had never before known what beauty meant. The light which she had been carrying was a tall candle in a silver candlestick, which she now set upon the table. If there had been any wind off the sea earlier in the night, it must have died down by now, for the flame of the candle burned as straight and still as if it were in a room with the window shut and the curtains drawn. Gold and silver on the table shone in its light. Lucy now noticed something lying lengthwise on the table, which had escaped her attention before. It was a knife of stone, sharp as steel, a cruel-looking, ancient-looking thing. No one had yet spoken a word. Then, Rip-Cheep first and Caspian next, they all rose to their feet, because they felt that she was a great lady. "Travellers, who have come from far to Aslan's table," said the girl, "why do you not eat and drink?"
"Madam," said Caspian, "we feared the food because we thought it had cast our friends into an enchanted sleep."
"They have never tasted it," she said.
"Please," said Lucy, "what happened to them?"
7 years ago," said the girl, "they came here in a ship, whose sails were rags, and her timbers ready to fall apart. There were a few others with them, sailors, and when they came to this table, one said, 'Here is the good place. Let us set sail and reef sail, and row no longer, but sit down and end our days in peace.' And the second said, 'No, let us re-embark and sail for Narnia and the west. It may be that Miraz is dead.' But the third, who was a very masterful man, leapt up and said, 'No, by heaven, we are men, and Telmarines, not brutes. What should we do but seek adventure after adventure? We have not long to live in any event. Let us spend what is left in seeking the unpeopled world behind the sunrise.' And as they quarrelled, he caught up the knife of stone which lies there on the table, and would have fought with his comrades. But it is a thing not right for him to touch. And as his fingers closed upon the hilt, deep sleep fell upon all the three. Until the enchantment is undone, they will never wake."
"What is this knife of stone?" asked Eustace.
"Do none of you know it?" said the girl.
I think, said Lucy, I've seen something like it before. It was a knife like it that the White Witch used when she killed Aslan at the stone table long ago. It was the same, said the girl, and it was brought here to be kept in honour while the world lasts.
Edmund, who had been looking more and more uncomfortable for the last few minutes, now spoke. "Look here," he said. "I hope I'm not a coward about eating this food, I mean, and I'm sure I don't mean to be rude, but we have had a lot of queer adventures on this voyage of ours, and things aren't always what they seem. When I look in your face, I can't help believing all you say. But then that's just what might happen with a witch, too. How are we to know you're a friend?"
"You can't know," said the girl. "You can only believe or not."
After a moment's pause, Weepy Cheep's small voice was heard.
"Sire," he said to Caspian, "of your courtesy, fill my cup with wine from that flagon. It is too big for me to lift. I will drink to the lady."
Caspian obeyed, and the mouse, standing on the table, held up a golden cup between its tiny paws and said,
"Lady, I pledge you."
Then it fell to on Cold Peacock, and in a short while everyone else followed its example. All were very hungry, and the meal, if not quite what you wanted for a very early breakfast, was excellent as a very late supper.
"Why is it called Aslan's table?" asked Lucy presently. "It is set here by his bidding," said the girl, "for those who come so far. Some call this island the world's end, for though you can sail further, this is the beginning of the end."
"But how does the food keep?" asked the practical Eustace.
"It is eaten and renewed every day," said the girl. "This you will see."
"And what are we to do about the sleepers?" asked Caspian. "In the world from which my friends come," here he nodded at Eustace and the Pevenses, "they have a story of a prince or a king coming to a castle where all the people lay in an enchanted sleep. In that story, he could not dissolve the enchantment until he had kissed the princess."
"But here," said the girl, "it is different. Here he cannot kiss the princess till he has dissolved the enchantment."
"Then," said Caspian, "in the name of Aslan, show me how to set about that work at once."
"My father will teach you that," said the girl.
"Your father?" said everyone. "Who is he, and where?"
"Look," said the girl, turning round and pointing at the door in the hillside. They could see it more easily now, for while they had been talking, the stars had grown fainter, and great gaps of white light were appearing in the greyness of the eastern sky. Chapter 14. The Beginning of the End of the World. Slowly the door opened again, and out there came a figure as tall and straight as the girl's, but not so slender. It carried no light, but light seemed to come from it. As it came nearer, Lucy saw that it was like an old man. His silver beard came down to his bare feet in front, and his silver hair hung down to his heels behind, and his robe appeared to be made from the fleece of silver sheep. He looked so mild and grave that once more all the travellers rose to their feet and stood in silence. But the old man came on without speaking to the travellers and stood on the other side of the table, opposite to his daughter. Then both of them held up their arms before them and turned to face the east. In that position they began to sing. I wish I could write down the song, but no one who was present could remember it. Lucy said afterwards that it was high, almost shrill, but very beautiful. A cold kind of song, an early morning kind of song.
And as they sang, the grey clouds lifted from the eastern sky, and the white patches grew bigger and bigger, till it was all white,
and the sea began to shine like silver. And long afterwards, but those two sang all the time, the east began to turn red, and at last, unclouded, the sun came up out of the sea, and its long level ray shot down the length of the table on the gold and silver and on the stone knife. Once or twice before, the Narnians had wondered whether the sun at its rising did not look bigger in these seas than it had looked at home. This time they were certain. There was no mistaking it, and the brightness of its rays on the dew and on the table were far beyond any morning brightness they had ever seen. And as Edmund said afterwards, though lots of things happened on that trip which sound more exciting, that moment was really the most exciting. For now they knew that they had truly come to the beginning of the end of the world. Then something seemed to be flying at them, out of the very centre of the rising sun. But of course one couldn't look steadily in that direction to make sure. But presently the air became full of voices, voices which took up the same song that the lady and her father were singing, but in far wilder tones, and in a language which no one knew. And soon after that, the owners of these voices could be seen. They were birds, large and white, and they came by hundreds and thousands, and alighted on everything, on the grass and the pavement, on the table, on your shoulders, your hands, and your head, till it looked as if heavy snow had fallen. For like snow, they not only made everything white, but blurred and blunted all shapes. But Lucy, looking out from between the wings of the birds that covered her, saw one bird fly to the old man with something in its beak that looked like a little fruit, unless it was a little live coal, which it might have been, but it was too bright to look at, and the bird laid it in the old man's mouth. Then the birds stopped their singing and appeared to be very busy about the table. When they rose from it again, everything on the table that could be eaten or drunk had disappeared. These birds rose from their meal in their thousands and hundreds, and carried away all the things that could not be eaten or drunk, such as bones, rinds, and shells, and took their flight back to the rising sun. But now, because they were not singing, the whir of their wings seemed to set the whole air a tremble, and there was the table, pecked clean and empty, and the three old lords of Narnia still fast asleep. Now, at last, the old man turned to the travellers and bade them welcome. "Sir," said Caspian, "will you tell us how to undo the enchantment which holds these three Narnian lords asleep?"
"I will gladly tell you that, my son," said the old man. "To break this enchantment you must sail to the world's end, or as near as you can come to it, and you must come back, having left at least one of your company behind."
"And what must happen to that one?" asked Weepy-Cheep.
"He must go into the utter east and never return into the world."
"That is my heart's desire," said Weepy-Cheep.
"And are we near the world's end now, sir?" asked Caspian. "Have you any knowledge of the seas and lands further east than this?"
"I saw them long ago," said the old man, "but it was from a great height. I cannot tell you such things as sailors need to know."
"Do you mean you were flying in the air?"
Eustace blurted out. "I was a long way above the air, my son," replied the old man. "I am Ramandu. But I see that you stare at one another and have not heard this name. And no wonder, for the days when I was a star had ceased long before any of you knew this world, and all the constellations have changed."
"Golly," said Edmund under his breath, "he's a retired star."
"Aren't you a star any longer?" asked Lucy.
"I am a star at rest, my daughter," answered Ramandu. "When I set for the last time, decrepit and old beyond all that you can reckon, I was carried to this island. I am not so old now as I was then. Every morning a bird brings me a fireberry from the valleys in the sun, and each fireberry takes away a little of my age. And when I have become as young as the child that was born yesterday, then I shall take my rising again. For we are at Earth's eastern rim, and once more tread the great dance.
In our world, said Eustace, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas.
Even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of. And in this world you have already met a star, for I think you have been with Coriakin.
Is he a retired star, too? Said Lucy.
Well, not quite the same, said Ramandu. It was not quite as a rest that he was set to govern the Duffers. You might call it a punishment. He might have shone for thousands of years more in the southern winter sky, if all had gone well.
What did he do, sir? Asked Caspian.
My son, said Ramandu, it is not for you, a son of Adam, to know what faults a star can commit. But come, we waste time in such talk. Are you yet resolved? Will you sail further east, and come again, leaving one to return no more, and so break the enchantment? Or will you sail westward?
Surely, sire, said Reepicheep, there is no question about that. It is very plainly part of our quest to rescue these three lords from enchantment.
I think the same, Reepicheep, replied Caspian. And even if it were not so, it would break my heart not to go as near the world's end as the Dawn Treader will take us. But I am thinking of the crew. They signed on to seek the seven lords, not to reach the rim of the earth. If we sail east from here, we sail to find the edge, the utter east, and no one knows how far it is. They're brave fellows, but I see signs that some of them are weary of the voyage, and long to have our prow pointing to Narnia. I don't think I should take them further without their knowledge and consent. And then there's the poor Lord Roop. He's a broken man.
My son, said the star, it would be no use, even though you wished it, to sail for the world's end with men unwilling, or men deceived. That is not how great unenchantments are achieved. They must know where they go and why. But who is this broken man you speak of?
Caspian told Ramandu the story of Roop.
I can give him what he needs most, said Ramandu. In this island there is sleep, without stint or measure, and sleep in which no faintest footfall of a dream was ever heard. Let him sit beside these other three, and drink oblivion till your return.
Oh, do let's do that, Caspian, said Lucy. I'm sure it's just what he would love.
At that moment they were interrupted by the sound of many feet and voices. Drinian and the rest of the ship's company were approaching.